Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, May 29th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt supervisors vouch for new water laws. Wailaki Redwood Canoe returns to the river. And Pacific Seafood closes its ground fish processing center. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Yesterday, the South Fork Lady Cubs took on the Los Molinos softball team in their first ever appearance in a state championship game, a historic milestone. For more details, we spoke with their coach.
I am Lisa Todd. I am head coach of the South Fork softball team. I had coached there for 22 years, took a three-year break, and then now am back.
The Lady Cubs faced numerous challenges over the past 2 years, including the lack of a coach, which prevented them from playing, prompting Lisa Todd to return. But this hiatus led to a rough start for the team. Despite the challenges, she noted that their hard work throughout the year was evident by the end of the season.
Had a rough season. We ended up tying for third with Ferndale. As the season progressed, they all went on. Then we made playoffs, and then we went on to win the Division 6 NCS, and the girls qualified for the first time ever for state. They were very excited because it was the farthest that the Lady Cubs had ever gone. Their morale during practice was great. They were excited. They wanted to keep winning. Practice went really well. They gave up their Memorial Day weekend to practice, or Memorial Day to practice. And they came ready to play hard.
On Tuesday, their season concluded with a 10-1 loss to Los Molinos. However, Coach Lisa Todd expressed immense pride in her players and their accomplishments despite the adversities they faced.
Yes, I'm very proud of them. They came a long way, and every team that we played against gave them props for never giving up. They will play till the bitter end. Very proud of them, but I appreciate all the hard work that they did this year. We had a lot to learn. I had a lot to learn about some of the players. They had to learn the way that I coach, and I think together in the end, we came together and became a family.
In closing, Coach Todd encourages young athletes to pursue their passions and urges the community to continue to support our students.
Work hard, and if it's a sport you truly love, do it outside of your season and work hard every day to get better. Support the local sports programs and watch these kids grow, because I think every program at South Park High School is going to get better as the years go on. They have a lot of good incoming younger athletes and baseball, football, everything coming up.
To stay up to date on all local games, you can follow South Fork High School on social media. New state laws enhancing water violation response and penalties are in the pipeline, and a majority of Humboldt County supervisors support them. Daniel Mintz reports.
New state laws changing water-related fines and regulations are afoot, and Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors supports them, but not unanimously. The scope of water use regulation was debated at the May 21st Supervisors meeting as the Board considered letters of support for two state bills. Assembly Bill 460 would significantly increase penalties and allow the state's Water Resources Control Board to issue interim relief orders on water use when it believes violations have occurred. A second bill, AB 1337, would strike water regulation exemptions for users whose water rights predate 1914. The argument in favor of AB 460 portrays it as a valid response to illegal water use, but Board Chair Rex Bone questioned the bill's legal conditions and said the county's agricultural operators are against it.
I can't support it in any way because basically the Farm Bureau opposes it. My dairymen this weekend, we talked about it. They're pretty much opposed to it. We're doing a pretty good job of driving agriculture out of California, and we put more regulations on their water. And I don't know if giving the power to the State Water Board without constitutional references or anything else is probably the best way to go. So I've got to oppose it just because our, as I said earlier, once we were the number one agricultural county in the state, and we still do pretty good with our dairy. We're number one in organic beef, and none of our farmers and dairymen actually see any benefit. Actually, they see quite a negative to this. It's reactionary.
AB 460's expansion of fines would raise them from $500 a day to $1,500, and violators of interim relief orders would face a $10,000 a day penalty. Supervisor Steve Madrone, who sponsored the letters along with Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, said higher penalties are necessary.
In fact, last year and in several years in the recent drought periods, there were water diverters that diverted and just took the fines because the fines were so small, they really had no effect on actually protecting that water for our endangered species, our fishermen and others that are also part of our economy. And so really this one is just simply that, trying to raise those fees to the point where it actually has an impact and tries to keep people working within their existing rights.
During a public comment period, representatives of Caltrout, Trout Unlimited, and Friends of the Eel River vouched for AB 460's enhancement of water board authority, as said here by Alicia Heyman, Friends of the Eel's executive director.
AB 460, it gives the water board stronger authority to stop illegal diversions, as well as the ability to increase penalties for water rights violations. You know, this is really important because, like a couple people have already said, the water board currently lacks the necessary tools to really meaningfully enforce our water rights regulations. And, you know, it just kind of makes me wonder, like, why make people comply with regulations if the violators are just going to continue, you know, breaking the law because they face such minimal penalties. So I appreciate the staff recommendation to provide a letter of support for this bill, and I highly encourage your board to follow that recommendation.
Responding to Bone's statements about the agriculture industry's opposition, Craig Tucker, a consultant for the Karuk tribe, said this is the second straight year of salmon fishing closures, and the water board, quote, needs more power to keep water in our rivers. Supervisors approved the letter of support, with Bone and Supervisor Michelle Bushnell voting against. Bushnell had said AB 460's scope goes beyond increasing fines, and its administrative remedies lack what she described as due process. The letter of support for the second bill was also approved with the same split voting. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Pacific Choice Seafoods is basically shutting down the plant, so they will not be buying and processing fish.
That was Harrison Eibach, the president of the Humboldt Fishermen's Marketing Association, who explained that the local fishing fleet is expressing concern over the recent move by Pacific Choice Seafood, the largest fish buying and processing plant in Eureka, to close their groundfish processing center. KMA News reached out to Pacific Seafood, and although they declined to interview, Lacey Ogan, the director of communications with the company, confirmed over email that they will not be processing groundfish in Eureka this season due to a weak market.
They've laid off most everybody that's there.
When asked about the layoffs, the company's director of communications replied, quote, team members who normally process groundfish in Eureka were given the opportunity to work at another facility for the summer, including relocation costs or a temporary separation package. Team members who return to Eureka in the fall to process crab are also eligible for a financial incentive, end quote. We asked Eibach how this will impact the local fleet.
Well, it's a really big deal. Pacific Choice Seafoods is a very large company. There's only so many processors that we have here in Humboldt Bay, and they are the largest, and they're a key component to the infrastructure, to the fishing industry that's here. They basically bought from most of the trawlers that operated out of Humboldt Bay, so yeah, it's kind of a significant, it, it really says a lot of what's going on with the seafood industry and the economy.
Pacific Seafood has played an important role in the fishing community and economy. By purchasing from local fishermen, the company helps small boats get their products to market. Now, the fleet will struggle to get their catch to the consumers.
There is a significant blow to the seafood industry just due to a lack of consumption. The markets are extremely volatile right now. There doesn't seem to be a good market for seafood in general. I believe it's economy-based, that most people view seafood as more of a luxury item, more of a luxury protein, and when times get tough economically, then most people really try to focus on buying some of the cheaper proteins, chicken and pork, even though that a lot of the fish is extremely affordable. Rockfish, groundfish in general, rockfish, lingcod, sole, is extremely affordable. People tend to kind of shy away from a lot of the seafood and when times get a little tough. So that's going to be extremely difficult for a lot of the fleet who needs to continue to fish. So coming back to your question, what are guys going to do? I guess that there's still a couple of processors that are here. Kaidos is still in Humboldt Bay, and there's also South Bend. But a lot of fishermen are probably going to have to get somewhat creative in order to move some of their product with the limited opportunities that they have to go fishing.
Ibog explains that this closure is indicative of the greater economic issues our community is facing. And with many other fisheries currently unstable, Ibog says morale is low.
The fleet is pretty beat up at the moment. We're finishing up our crab season, but we had another difficult beginning to our crab season where we did not receive the best price available. Humboldt Bay received $1 to $1.50 less price per pound on Dungeness crabs than the entire state of Oregon. So that did not sit very well at all. Also a lack of seasons as well and opportunities. Like, for example, they've shut down the California salmon troll fishery again for the second year in a row. Pack Choice is wrapping up shop. The markets in general are very low. The prices of ground fish are extremely low. We haven't quite heard what the albacore prices are yet. But that being said, yeah, the fleet feels pretty beat up. Everyone's a little, the future is a little uncertain for some. I know a lot of the older gentlemen are looking to try to retire and sell their boats. That is also not going very well, but boat sales and permit sales are quite low at the moment as well. So yes, a lot of people are quite deflated at the moment.
According to the USDA, consumer demand for seafood in the United States has risen over the last three decades. But to meet rising consumer demand, the United States has become reliant on global suppliers, and they estimate that about 80% of U.S. consumption of seafood comes from abroad, $2 billion of which from China. In 2023, Congressman Jared Huffman released a press release stating that the U.S. is violating its own trade laws to buy seafood from foreign countries. Within that press release, it stated that over 17% of seafood imports from China were caught illegally. With that, IBOC implores local fish eaters to check their sources when buying seafood.
We need to have better control as a nation over the imports that we do, the seafood that we import. I think it needs to be better tracked. You know, there's a lot of fishing practices that are not sustainable, and somehow that unsustainable seafood is still imported into this country and definitely consumed. All of this unregulated, unsustainable seafood to basically infiltrate the country. And that seems to be one of the biggest hurdles that we have right now.
Residents can buy directly from the source at the docks in Eureka, located on Woodley Island.
Absolutely. We'll definitely be setting up shop there At some point here, we'll be transitioning from crab into fish, and so will some other people as well. So some food will definitely be available at the docks. We're hanging in there, and as time moves forward, there seems to be some new marketing opportunities that are being discussed to try to provide more locally caught seafood available to the local area. So stand by on that. We'll keep you updated on that sort of news in the future. But we're still going, and there's still fish available.
Cayman News will continue to share updates. On June 1st, members of the Round Valley and Wailaki or Kinistet tribes will hold a ceremony to honor the creation of their hand-carved redwood canoe on the main stem of the Eel River. This tradition, practiced since time immemorial, was halted after first contact with Europeans. This will mark the first time in over 100 years that a redwood canoe returns to the river. K-Mud freelancer Sam Anderson visited the site where the canoe is being carved and shares this story.
This rhythmic sound is not a drum, but the sound of an adze, a wood carving tool sinking into a big redwood log. I'm standing in the shade at Yuki Trails, a community center in Kovalo, watching Perry Lincoln and his friend Mudcat whittle away at a traditional dugout canoe. It's a project that is nearly 2 years in the making and just weeks away from completion. Lincoln is the director of a group called Native Health in Native Hands.
And the way we say it in our language is Choget Holabet, which means the medicine to heal ourselves is in our hands. Our goal is to work with youth and to work with families and to work with just people on our own cultural revival.
This is actually the second canoe that Lincoln has made in the traditional fashion. The first one began along the Eel River, where they were historically made in the past. That canoe was later brought up to Eureka, but the distance made it difficult for people from Round Valley to participate in the project. So Lincoln's friend Mudcat began laying the groundwork to start a new canoe project here in Kovalo.
In that time, Mud was really trying to get a log together so that we could do a canoe here in Round Valley for the people to bring it to them so that they could have something to come to and help bring us all together.
Here's Mudcat.
Many of us that are here in this valley, this is history in the making for us. It's actually the first one that we have made, and I heard like 175 years for our people, for the Wailakis. So I'm very glad to be part of this and have this log here.
And this is no ordinary log.
This one came from the Avenue of the Giants, and we have ties to that land. Some of our grandparents, our great-great-grandfathers were from that land.
The famous Avenue of the Giants in Humboldt County, where this particular canoe originated, is a protected forest. But if a tree falls in the wind or has to be removed by the Park Service for safety reasons, it can become available to Native American groups who have a cultural history of working with redwood. In the past, for the indigenous peoples living along the rivers of Northern California, canoes like this one were absolutely essential. Here's Lincoln again.
This canoe would be used as like our highway was the river. We could transport whatever we needed. We had trading goods, we had people. We needed to transport at different times from one place to another. So the river was the fastest access. You know, in the morning it's cool to travel down the river, and then in the evening the wind blows back up the river, so it's not as hard to bring this back up the river in the evening time when the wind's blowing.
Lincoln runs his hand over the rough-hewn canoe as his grandson, Ernest, uses a big wooden caliper to take a measurement.
It's four.
Four. You can make a little groove in there if you want to.
He explains that using traditional methods, a canoe like this one would take his ancestors up to 5 years to complete.
And they're dug out with, in the past, it was the materials that people had, elkhorn wedges, rocks, obsidian, and fire. They used fire to burn out the inside. So those were the tools we had to use back in the day. Now we're using chainsaws and planers and sanders.
Even with modern technology, this project has still taken nearly 2 years to complete. I ask Lincoln what keeps him going.
Well, we want people to know that there's a big movement with Native people, especially up north, Klamath River people, Yurok people, Cudahy people and Hoopoe people have been struggling for years to keep their culture, their language, their ceremonies, and all the cultural resources intact. And they've done a great job all these years. And so right now, since we don't have the land base that we used to have, we're working with land access, and we want people to know that we can share our traditional knowledges to bring employment, to bring a better land use practice.
The Native Health and Native Hands Group is part of a broader effort by Native peoples in California to build coalitions with state and national parks, restoration groups, and other government agencies to share management of public lands and use traditional ecological knowledge to mitigate environmental issues.
You know, there's been a lot of practices like overlogging, taking the water to somewhere else, and that creates problems. It's only been like 100 and something years that the land is really dangerous. Like, there's catastrophic fires happening, but Native people have a lot of answers to what's happening. And they're actually reaching out to Native people. So to educate Native people here and to educate non-Native people is our main goal.
It's a goal that's far-reaching. But for Lincoln and his family, the process of building this traditional dugout has also been deeply personal.
For me, it's just a good learning experience. I'm glad to be out here doing this with my family.
That's Lincoln's grandson, Ernest.
Definitely glad to be doing something for my people. I hope one day that I could pass on what I've learned here to future generations, and then they pass it along to other generations, and it just keeps going from there.
Mudcat agrees that a big part of this project is the impact he hopes it will have on future generations of Native families.
One day there's going to be a little kid that grows up here and said, I remember them always doing that here. We want the kids to say, they've always done it here.
For now, you can find Mudcat, Lincoln, and his family working on the canoe on the first and third Wednesdays of the month at Yuki Trails in Covelo.
Come see it for yourself if you can. Come over to Yuki Trails and just come watch or participate. We're always welcoming helping hands.
For me, working with my son and my grandsons, you know, that's something that not a lot of people really experience, you know. To work with my family and them teach me and me share a little bit of knowledge that I have, it was like, I there's not even words for me for that experience, you know.
An experience that began thousands of years ago alongside the Eel River right here in Mendocino. And through the work of Lincoln and his family, that experience continues to this day. Reporting from Covelo for KMUD News, I'm Sam Anderson.
On June 1st, members of the public are invited to join Save California Salmon, Native Health and Native Hands, the Coastal Conservancy, the Round Valley Indian Health Center, and the Trees Foundation as they host Ha Cho Kut Kinestet, Wailaki People on the River, a cultural exchange where Eel River tribes and community members share wellness through tribal cultural exchanges and recreation. River rafting will be offered to the community by Six Rivers Rafting, free for all ages. Rafting begins at Alder Point, with a takeout at Fort Seward. Participants are asked to gather by 9 a.m., and lunch will be provided. Registration is required. For more, you can contact Phil, P-H-I-L, at californiasalmon.org to reserve your spot. Republicans reject bipartisan Senate border security bill for the second time. Christopher Martinez reports.
Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan says it provides tools to fight drug trafficking at the border, especially of the deadly drug fentanyl. Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire says Thursday's vote will be a chance to put the bill back on track, and she hopes Republicans join.
There are a lot of things that I disagree with the majority of my Republican colleagues about. But this is one I agree on. We do need to address border security at our southern border. And that's what this legislation that we voted on 105 days ago and we're going to vote on again tomorrow would do.
Senate Leader Schumer says he does not expect all Democratic senators to vote for the measure, but he says he wants a bipartisan majority with Democratic and Republican votes. But Democrats may not be getting much help from the other side of the aisle. Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma plans to vote against the bill, even though he was a lead negotiator and one of the four Republicans to vote for it in February. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who also helped the earlier negotiations, now says bringing it back for another vote is a gimmick. Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee spoke at a Senate Republican news conference to, in her words, talk about this border bill that is not a border bill.
This is an election year political stunt designed to give our Democratic colleagues the appearance of doing something about the problem without doing anything at all.
She says the bill has already failed, and this time she says it has no chance in the House of Representatives. She says Democrats are the party of open border, and they intend to keep it that way.
There is a distinct difference between Republicans and Democrats when we're talking about border security. The left means release and resettle. When Republicans talk about border security, we mean deny and deport.
Republicans are not the only critics of the border bill. Some immigrant rights activists are blasting it as a step backwards. The coalition Welcome with Dignity held its own news conference to talk about the border bill. Robin Barnard is senior director of refugee advocacy with Human Rights First. She says the Border Act would do permanent damage to the U.S. asylum system and put vulnerable people at risk.
A yes vote on this anti-immigrant bill is a vote for historical betrayal of U.S. commitment to asylum and refugee protection.
She says the bill would codify an expulsion policy, take asylum decisions out of the courts, and reinstate funds for the Donald Trump border wall construction. Maribel Hernandez Rivera is the American Civil Liberties Union's Director of Policy and Government Affairs for Border and Immigration. She says Democrats voted for the bill in February with the excuse that it was critical to aid Ukraine. But she says that is no longer the case.
And we are now completely capitulating to the right. We are completely copying the Stephen Miller approach and playbook. We're completely bringing back Trump-era policies, and we're codifying them.
She says what's really needed is a legal path to citizenship for Dreamers, farm workers, and people fleeing humanitarian crises. That is a big ask, given the narrowly divided Congress and election year politics. Blaine Bookie is legal director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She points to a political downside for the Biden administration.
This also is not winning the administration any political points. Biden just can't out-Trump Trump.
Activists will be continuing their work because, as the ACLU's Hernandez Rivera says, there is a better way.
We do not need to sacrifice our nation's values or moral commitments in order to address the challenges at the border.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Christopher Martinez, Daniel Mintz, and Sam Anderson. Reporting for KMUD in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.